on how we can learn from the experiments we do, with some how, you know, what knowledge we're going to take away and how we're going to use that to design the next sort of experiments. Now, when Robin first talked to me about coming here, I had actually thought I would talk about this talk subject. We've been working very hard with Joseph Emerson, Cecilia Lopez, Raymond Flamme, his students, to come up with experimental measures that we could help motivate discussions of fault tolerance. As an experimentalist, you know, you get tired of hearing you need fidelities of 9999 or however many nines you want, and no relationship to the physics. And we thought that, and we still think that that there are physical questions which we could answer that would motivate whether it's reasonable to think about systems being fault tolerant in the future. And I just give a few of these. You know, we could ask, well, how quickly do two body terms actually fall off with distance? We could ask, how important are in-body terms? Really important. We could ask about the correlations of noise, the spatial and temporal correlations of noise. And but having sat through the talks earlier in the week, I changed my mind. There was a reasonable amount of this has been talked about. And I think that there's a lot of bread and butter. What do you do in a lab when you've made a measurement? How do you learn from it? And how do we really want to use process tomography or even state tomography? And you know, actually, when we carry out tomography, I don't really care too much about what the state is. What I want to know is what it tells me about my my model. Is it consistent with the model I have of the system? Can I learn to improve the model? And then can I hopefully find a better way of controlling the system? So I want to go through a couple of case studies with you. I'm going to start off, yeah.
First talk somewhere else that I can go listen to it. That
sounds cool too. I'll be back at IQC in a couple of weeks, so we can get together and do that. It is a nice topic, and there's it's early days in that topic. There's a lot to be learned. But I'm sorry, I'm going to talk about this stuff today, or do it all on the board. That would be good too. I'm going to talk a little bit about liquid state NMR, where we really do have good control, but we're going to try to tune up the control by doing things like process tomography because our control is so good that we're looking for subtle errors, and it's a good place to get subtle errors. And then I'm going to move on to more recent systems, and I'm going to make sure that I spend time here. My lab, although you know you might think of us as NMR lab, we're doing experiments in superconducting persistent current flux qubits. And I want to tell you about a system there where really we don't know very much. And the approaches we take are therefore quite different. My collaborators, lots of funding sources. I want to point out Tim Howell, who really should be here, although he's moved on to bigger and better things. I'll point out a few talks. He's done all the theory behind what we've done. I'll show work that Jakob Weinstein has done. We're going to start there. Then talk about things that Michael and Paula and Jonathan Hodges have done. And we'll work that we do in flux qubits is in collaboration with Jonas Bylander and Will Oliver. All right. Really basic stuff first. We start off saying, yeah, we do NMR, we have an internal Hamiltonian, and the internal Hamiltonian tells us that we have some interaction of the spins with the magnetic field, and that the spins are coupled to each other. Actually, it's sigma dot sigma coupling. I should read my own slides before I show them. And that there's a set of control fields that we apply that will rotate the system. And so since there's a bilinear coupling
And we have quantization energy. Yeah, we have universal control of life. It's really good. However, if we look a little bit more detail at this system, the quantization axis depends upon the strength of the magnetic field. It's directly proportional to the magnetic field. And though we try very hard to have the magnetic field being homogeneous over our sample, it's not. It's a macroscopic sample. It occupies some cubic millimeters, and there's a variation in that. The radio frequency fields that we apply are intentionally inhomogeneous, intentionally in terms that we maximize the sensitivity. NMR is a wonderful technique, but it's bloody insensitive. And so we make sure that the energy that we're detecting with is maximized, but we don't care about actually the actual terms. And so if I measure a distribution, remember that we have a spatially distributed sample. If I had a distribution function of the strength of the RF field and the strength of the static field, it would look like something like this, that it would tend to move off to one direction, and that it would be correlated over space. What we would like to have, what we're going to work hard to do, is to have a control sequence which works for every element of this distribution. Okay, I don't want it to work for an average element of the distribution. I don't want it to work for some subset of those. But I'd like it to work for every element of that distribution. Yeah?
In what sense does having a non-constant RF
lets me put the coil close to the sample.
I see.
Okay. And if I put the coil close to the sample, it's going to be inhomogeneous. Thanks for the question. So when we have a model of our system, we have a model of the chemical shifts. And you know, there's a finite precision to which we know those. Also, of course, we're looking at some 10 to 17 copies of a molecule, and they're not all the same. You know, it's a bit of a drag, but some are going to be next to the tube. Some are going to be in the middle of the sample. Some are going to have different isotopes for the for the uninteresting spins in the sample. So we have a distribution of chemical shifts. Coupling constants, we hope, are the same, but they have isotopic shifts too. We have these ranges of fields. There are other spins in the samples we need to worry about. In the hardware, we need to model that too, that we have RF transmitters that are applying our control sequences. They're pretty linear, but the nonlinearities are important. We're driving reactive elements. The transients associated with those are important. And of course, we have the various relaxation times and correlation times of noise generators. We want to put all of that into the system, and then to use that information to find the best way of coherently controlling our system. Now, you're going to hear about this. I just gratuitously stuck this slide in here so I could point to Tim's paper, which probably doesn't get enough attention. But Some time ago, we spent a lot of time doing process tomography to measure the internal Hamiltonian. And of course, it's going to measure the internal Hamiltonian. It'll measure the relaxation superoperator. And we measure this superoperator at multiple time points, give all the data to Tim, and then he extracts for us both the Hamiltonian description of the internal Hamiltonian. This is all experimental data, of course. And the relaxation times. And of course, none of that is strictly diagonal. And if you look carefully, there's small terms below it up. There's lots of small terms. He's done a good job of doing that, and you'll find the paper there. And so this is part of the data that goes into our model for understanding this structure. Okay, yeah.
I remember reading that paper, and I thought I remembered that you measure the superoperator at a succession of times, and then you want to fit a generator to that.
Yeah.
The short question is, was that fit really nice, or was it kind of messy?
It's nice. Now, it's very hard to do, because, of course, you're measuring terms that are oscillating very quickly. And also, you're measuring terms that are decaying very slowly. And we're not going to take enough data being lazy experimentalists, to have data coming out long enough times to have the full decay at the resolution that would fully describe all the frequencies. And so we have, you know, a number of points that are finely spaced, and then we have some points out here and out here. So it's nothing like Fourier sampling, but you can still sort it all out.
So your time slicing resolution does seem to be enough to resolve the high frequency.
Yeah, we do that initially, and then we give time, then we take some points longer, further out in time to get the decays. But of course, you have to pay attention to all those frequencies.
But a Markovian fit was good.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay, so given all that, we stick it into a model and we try to calculate, to find some pulse like this, which I don't even remember what it particularly does, but it has a shape like this that generates a high fidelity on average, a high fidelity over that whole distribution. And the key to this, why I like to show this slide, is to notice here I've plotted the gate fidelity versus the modulation frequency. So this is how fast we drive the system. That's our radio frequency pulse drive. The stronger we drive it, of course, the more we can dominate the internal Hamiltonians, the more we can dominate these distributions, the higher fidelity we can get. I've plotted this out for three different magnetic field strengths. The higher the magnetic field strength you have, the more distinguishable, the better you can address those spins. We get up to the higher fidelity. Okay, you do all that, and then Jakob Weinstein measured for three spins the super operator for the quantum Fourier transform. So this is, you know, Fourier transform we all know and love. He does this by preparing a complete set of input states, and he then, of course, for each of those does full state tomography. This is a paper that describes that work. And it's pretty nice. You say, okay, there's a theoretical superoperator, there's the experimental superoperator. And the first time I showed this to Henry Everett, who most of you will know, being a drag, Henry would say, well, what does that line mean? So, okay, I'll show you. So we want to try to get information from them. And the information I want isn't just that there's a certain fidelity. I want to get more information than the fact that there was a fidelity. And Jakob did this experiment once. It's some months of experiments. And then I didn't like the data when he told me how he was calculating the pulses. He wasn't including the full model. And so he had the penalty of going back and doing it a second time. But it gave us two data sets to compare, which is very nice, but it wasn't his design. So what I show you here is the Krauss operator decomposition of those two data sets. In the dark is the second experiment, which is a more complete model. And in the light is the first experiment. And you can see right away some nice features. Then yes, when we have a more complete model, the amplitude of the first Krauss operator increases. That's good.
But are you saying you've got a more complete model when you're doing the reconstruction, or
no,
somehow when you're doing the experiment?
When I'm calculating the control sequences for the experiment.
That's the working out how long you apply the pulses and stuff for.
Yeah, only it's not how long, it's what the shape is. So we calculate a pulse shape for some action that is going to give us the correct unitary over all the elements of our distribution, of our system model. So it says that, yes, knowing that you have different chemical shifts, that you have a range of amplitudes of the radio frequency field, that I have a range of distributions of the static magnetic field, that I might have some other isotopes in there, that my amplifier has certain nonlinearities or transients, you put that all in there, and you search for
It is bloody inefficient, but it works. You search for a pulse that compensates for all of that. And you know, the quality of that pulse is dependent upon the quality of your model. And so if we don't include the full model, then we don't get as good a unitary. Now that pulse I show you, that pulse is a pulse of applying a 90-degree pulse or something like that to a set of spins. That's not the pulse that does a quantum Fourier transform. The quantum Fourier transform is the gate sequence we all know and love, which is going to be made up of dozens and dozens of those pulses. Yes.
What is the size of your system? So the maximum number of Krauss operators that might be?
Good question. So it's three spins. Uh-huh. So I haven't shown you all of them yet.
This here is 35.
Yeah, I'll get there. But you're exactly right. I haven't shown them all.
Close.
Yeah.
David, when you're designing those control pulses,
yeah.
You've probably already told me this, so I apologize for asking again. Your entire Fourier transform is made up of a whole bunch of this and that and the other pulses. And your optimization, do you focus more on some types of pulses than the others, or is it an overall, let's try the whole darn sequence with every possible?
So we optimize the gates. We don't optimize over the Fourier transform. So what we do in this case is we optimize a pulse for giving a Hadamard transform.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so let's look at this a little bit carefully. So here I show you the unitary for the QFT. And now I show you the first Krauss operator. So this is just the Krauss operator with the largest action in the uncompensated and the compensated set. And you can see, I hope that the compensated set is closer to the QFT, right? So that the dominant action is that. Notice that what's happened here is that, yes, the intensity of the first Krauss operator goes up. Now, that intensity, of course, is not the fidelity, because this is not all the quantum Fourier transform action. That the second Krauss operator is not in this broad background of errors, that actually there are unique recognizable errors in that second Krauss operator. We'll talk about that. And that, of course, is this broad distribution of Krauss operators that says there's a lot of action going on in the system that is not easily described has been reduced. Yeah.
I know you're going to show this in the next slide, but while we're still looking at this one, can you remember what the process fidelity was? Just some overall fidelity number?
No, but I will show it to you. I'll come back to this after. Let's just jump over there. Oh, yeah. It's right here. So the So these are the numbers. So I think that this must be for the second data set. So the gate fidelity for the whole quantum Fourier transform is that, and this is the average projection over the various operators that span it between the two.
You've got 64 of them.
Yeah. Yes. That's right. Now, this is the slot you were looking for. So here I show you that in this reconstruction, we have negative eigenvalues in our Krauss operator. And don't jump up and down and tell me this is non-physical. This is an experiment. This is physical. But what's happening, of course, is I told you we have these distributions. And those distributions in our control Hamiltonians exist also when we're preparing the initial state. And so when we prepare the initial state of our system, we are writing into the system correlations. And when we rotate the final system to extract those, we get essentially an echo occurring. And so in this system, if I focus the Krauss decomposition on only that central piece of the quantum Fourier transform, and I leave out the crucial part of preparing the initial states and reading out the initial states, then it's quite correct that we would have a Krauss decomposition with negative values. Okay, and I don't, I'm happy with that. Yeah, I'd like to remove it, but I'm happy with it because it tells us something about the distribution, and we're going to see how well it fits our model. And actually, and since my goal is to make sure that this fits the model, this is good. We have the system that we want. And here I show you now the Krauss operators. This is just the first Krauss operator with the simulated Krauss operator. So this is with our model. Of course, it's not unitary because we're making a distribution. Oh, we're modeling over a distribution. And you can see that the overlap between the experimental first Krauss operator and the simulated first Krauss operator are actually reasonably good. It's not so bad for the second one either. Oh, so this is actually just the unitary of that.
So how did you model the initial correlation in this simulated version?
I have a model. I know the distribution of fields in my system, okay. Right? And so I just run that forward. So with the known model of the distribution of fields, okay. With the known model of any distributions in the system, we simply run that forward, okay, and we will end up with a set with a super operator, which is not going to be completely positive.
So the differences in the negative value indicates that your model of initialization, the preparation, wasn't correct.
I mean, you're worried about this piece?
Yeah, the negative values of the Krauss operator.
Okay. That's a very small amount of the action.
Okay.
Right, so let me continue.
Okay.
And we'll see that answer, but thank you. So let's look at the super operator in a few different ways. I'm going to try to get some information. I'll answer this question. The Marco Saraceni was with us, and the first way of looking at the Fourier transform was to say, hey, let's look at it in phase space. We're looking at it in phase space. Of course, it's a permutation operator. And you know, it's nice that when we go from the uncompensated to the compensated experiment, things get cleaner. But we don't do our experiments in phase space.
Those dots mean what?
This is the intensity. Right, so if I have the superoperator of the QFT, there's a permutation operator in phase space. And so with this particular ordering, in theory, only those values should be non-negative. Everything, you know, should be 1, everything else is 0. And you see that in fact, the experimental data has some of that structure in it. Yeah. And the Zeeman basis, it looks a little bit more interesting as well, but the one that helps us the best here is to look at it in the operator basis that we actually do our experiments. So what I'm showing you here is the super operator in the basis that we do our experiments, and this is the experimental super operator, of course, and I've removed from it the action of the QFT. So we've removed from it the ideal QFT, not the simulated QFT, but the ideal QFT. And we wanted to know, hey, what are the residual errors in this? And we can directly see the residual errors here. That what we find, just you'll have to trust me on the terms, is that this cross peak here tells us that we have sigma x3 going to sigma y3. And we can go down, and for each of these off-diagonal elements, we can identify what the action is. We find that the largest error in this system is just a sigma z3 error, but a very simple error associated with a rotation about the z-axis on the third step. And the second error is also just a single spin rotation. And we understand where these came from. These came from transients in our system that we hadn't appropriately modeled. And so using this, we could improve our model. And if I could have convinced Jakob to not graduate and run off to industry, He could have run the experiment for a third time and showed you he had to further improvement, but I wasn't able to do that. I'm going to skip this.
Sure.
I mean, one of the nice things of looking incoherences is to look at the distribution of eigenvalues of the superoperator. And again, a paper by Tim and Nicholas Boulant and Zig Furuta, Journal of Chemical Physics, describes how to do this. And of course, what you'd expect to see is that if you have incoherence, you get a distribution of eigenvalues spread out inside the unit circle. Of course, the QFT ideally has four eigenvalues. So that these errors that we would see in this part of the simulation, although they're on the unit's circle, are unitary errors. And of course, if you have decoherence, what you end up usually doing is reducing the whole circle and adding in a line here at zero, at one. So this is the experiment distribution. Yeah.
Just in the previous slide, you pointed out that most of your errors are dominated by a couple of elements of the process matrix. So in the discussion of large systems the other day, and before that, Juan Pablo told us about a method for directly measuring a particular element of the superoperator if you know what to look for.
Yeah.
The question is, could you have guessed what to look for somehow ahead of time without doing the huge amount of work to do full process tomography?
We could have arranged an experiment that would look for just this error, not under the action of the quantum Fourier transform, but just to parameterize our system model. So NMR has been around for more than 50 years, so we have these long recipes of do this. They work. These methods that are in the folklore of NMR work really well when you know that you have one error and you're trying to reduce the error to zero. You know, the feature that I hope Juan Pablo is going to teach us is how to use methods to find an error which is not the biggest error. That to selectively measure an error even though there are other things happening. Yeah? No. Okay. Well, hopefully, yes, then. Not today. So what did we learn? Okay, we learned that we could measure the superoperator as many times as we wanted, which was 2 for the student. We got a gate fidelity with the theoretical superoperator of 0.64. Doesn't sound so good. But the correlation between the two superoperators, one that we simulated with our full system model and one that we measured experimentally, is 0.79. That sounds a little bit better. Your question about the complete positivity was a very small change. We could remove completely the non-positivity, and the correlation between the superoperator before and after that is 0.97, so that's really good. By coincidence, it's also, if we took in those two errors that we measured of single spin rotations, and we simply rotate the experimental superoperator by those values, and then measure the correlation of that with the simulated superoperator, our correlation goes up to 0.97. So in this case, the errors really are dominated by those two small rotations. And we can remove those. Okay. So what I would like to say there, and I look for, I'm going to skip a whole slew of slides, is that quantum process tomography to us is still the best way of, at the end of the day, finding out if our model is good. Now, it's only going to help us when we get to this point that we have such good control that it's worth looking at complicated dynamics of the system. But once we do that, then we can learn a great deal from quantum process tomography, and we can use that to improve our model and to come up with a better one. And of course, if we have a better model, we get better control sequences. Now something completely different. Okay, so now I'm going to turn to new experiments, the first experiments seeing coherence in persistent current flux qubits. So remember that there's a whole slew of families of superconducting qubits. This is a set of qubits that were introduced by Terry Orlando and that Lincoln Lab people have been making. And the idea of it is that we have a loop with two superconducting junctions, and so there's a persistent current in this loop, and it will flow in one direction or the other. If we're sitting at the degeneracy point, then we'll find that there's an energy level split in here. There's an anti-crossing, and so we have two solutions equally valid. We have a fine qubit here. And the coupling of that anti-crossing we can control by this separate loop. And so the picture of the space is that I have a single anti-crossing. There's a flux bias, which is the amount of flux that I inject into this loop here. And there's a coupling term here, which by convention is assigned sigma x. And this bias is, of course, an orthogonal direction. And so we'll call that sigma z. OK, so we have a qubit that we can operate on. And the fun thing about this qubit is that by controlling the flux here, I can shift this coupling. OK, so I can make it stronger. So finally, we have one that we can see Rami oscillations for. And so I show you here the data at the anti-crossing, so at this degeneracy point. And everything is relative to the quantization axis of sigma x. And so we have a T1 of 300 nanoseconds, a T2 star. It's a funny system here that there's only noise injected along sigma z and sigma x. There's no noise along sigma y in this interaction frame. And so T2 can be twice T1. And so the fact that T2 star is longer than T1 is perfectly acceptable. Now the Hamiltonian for this system has the coupling term. It has a bias term to move us on the horizontal axis, I showed you over there. But because everything's flux coupled, when we move on the horizontal axis, we change the coupling, the anti-crossing level, a little bit. We can put flux into this loop. That'll change the coupling term. And again, everything is flux coupled, so we'll change the bias a little bit. But you can take these epsilons as being pretty small. They're not equal to each other. And then we apply microwave radiation to drive us between those two energy levels to cause transitions. And we apply that along sigma z. But again, it's flux coupled, the same little story. And we get a little bit of sigma x. Okay. So there's this picture. And initially, it looks pretty good. We have T1s, T2s. The echo time is not very different than T2 star. Bums you out, right? You like that to be longer. But the really weird thing is that the Rabi time, if I sit here and I apply a Rabi field, then the decay of the Rabi oscillations is longer than either T2 star or the echo time. And so what's happening here is that the Rabi oscillation is able to average out some of the noise. That, remember that the Rabi is averaging out noise that's perpendicular to sigma z, whereas the echo is averaging out noise that's perpendicular. That's along sigma x.
Is that the visibility of the Rabi flopping is not yet 100%.
Right.
Is the 0.6 what you'd expect given the parameters of the system, or is it something that
it's smaller than it should be? Okay. And we're only just coming up with a system model. So, you know, I'm not going to say what I would expect.
Yeah.
Total ignorance question. What's T-echo?
So echo is to say, imagine I apply 90-degree volts. Sometime later, I apply 180-degree volts, flip the stage over. If it's evolving under the same noise, then everything should come back together at the time T later. And so the echo time is going to tell us of our ability to refocus noise, which is along the x-axis and has a long correlation time. Other questions? Okay. So now what I do, or what Jonas does, this is all Jonas's data, Jonas Weiland. What Jonas does is he moves away from this anti-crossing. So he's going to move off. And when he does that, of course, the quantization axis of the system is going to change. As he does this, it's going to rotate from being along sigma x towards sigma z. Okay, so we have a tilted reference frame. And you see that T1 is nice and flat. That's good. What T1 being flat tells us is that the high-frequency noise is pretty isotropic. Wherever the high-frequency noise is coming from, it doesn't pick out one quantization axis. It all looks the same. We find that the T2, well, let me just go to the next slide. I've plotted this out bigger so you can actually see it. The T2 and the T-echo fall off very quickly. Okay, so here the noise really does matter. And that the Rabi oscillation always stays above this. That the Rabi, we can always get more averaging with Rabi. Okay. So that all looks good. And I wondered why with the Rabi, you know, the Rabi's long. I'm going to take and play with that one first. Let's take the longest times and look at those because they're going to be sensitive. And I wondered why it was that it wasn't even longer. It could be twice T1, right? And so we carry out an experiment called a rotary echo that says, let me drive the experiment with an RF field along the z-axis for some time. And then I'm going to change the phase by 180 degrees. I'm going to drive it backwards. And if I drive it forward for some time and I drive it backwards for an equal amount of time, it should end up back where it was, and I'll get an echo. And what I would like to see is the time scale of that echo. And here's the data that you have. So this is the visibility. So it should be red. Versus the pulse width in nanoseconds going out to 750 nanoseconds. And I've just taken the nicest slice out of that. And you can see that, yes, we have signal coming out for a very long time, out to 750 nanoseconds and longer. There's some high frequency oscillations, which should be there. And there's this low frequency oscillation, which we can never get rid of, which should not be there. The high frequency oscillations, you can understand. They come. Imagine yourself x, z, y, and you apply some drive field along this direction, and then you're going to apply a drive field for the same period of time along that direction. Everything should get back to where they should be. But in reality, everything's tilted a little bit. We're not applying it exactly about z. We're applying it shifted up a little bit. And so you get a little bit more complicated modulation, a little bit more complicated dynamics. But this still should not be there. So there's something coherent going on in the system.
Is that just misaligned components, or is there some fundamental reason?
No, there's something not in my model that's causing that.
But the fast stuff is just because of this coupling.
The fast stuff is because of this, right? Or was that your question? Right. The fast stuff is because I have a cone here, and then I have a cone here, right? And they only overlap at one line.
Could this result from a time-dependent phase shift in your IV oscillations?
It could. It could result also from a time-dependent amplitude term, but something that is coherent. You know, so at one point we were using two different synthesizers that were locked to each other.
And you
said, hey, it must be that, but it wasn't.
Have you tuned omega C? Stay at the point of the anti-crossing and tune omega C. And do you see that is the decay time? I guess it should be linear in omega C.
In this particular device, we can't tune omega C very far, and so we don't see a difference with that. But the range over which we can tune omega C in this device is so small. I don't know if I can believe that data yet.
Okay. Beg your pardon, was that limits on omega C tuning at all related to the visibility of Robbie?
Nope.
Okay, thanks. That's it.
All right. It gets funkier. I mean that sort of stuff we can sort of explain and add to the noise term. Okay. And we'll get there. But here I wanted to do an experiment to look directly at the noise sources. And my favorite experiment for doing this is called spin locking. What I do is I rotate the state by 90 degrees, and then I apply a locking field right along it. And what should happen is nothing. It should stay there. Now, of course, it's going to slowly decay, right? But the state and the field commute. Nothing should happen. Now, then I add in some errors, some noise. And I'm going to take the amplitude of this field that I'm driving the system, locking the system with, I'm going to vary that amplitude. And if that amplitude is really small, and so that the noise terms are bigger than it, I measure T2 star. Right? Then the noise is going to drive the system, not the field. If I increase the strength of that drive field, then this relaxation time should go up, and it should go up, and it should approach T1. Okay, at the limit, it should be T1. Not twice T1, T1. We do that experiment, and this is 2 milliseconds out here. And we say, hey, man, how come this is lasting so long? And then we do the experiment in a funky fashion. Not quite the exact experiment I would have wanted to do. I'm not going to ask you a question if you want. We measure the time, the decay time, versus the amplitude. And we see that things fall down. I'll accept that. But we see that they also jump up to 140 to 4 times, more than 4 times T1. Okay, so now the model can't be exactly right, because you say, hey, you don't get anything 4 times T1. I don't know what's going on. One of the things I suspect is going on is that we're connecting to other quantum systems. But it's where we're at, it's the next step, and now the trick is to try to find a way to learn about these noise generators that are happening at this frequency. I mean, here's the good news. The good news is something funky happens at one particular frequency. Right? And so I don't know what the Hamiltonian is. I don't know what the direction. Unfortunately, I don't even know what the space is. But I do know what the frequency is. And we'll take any information we can get. Okay, I'm going to stop here. So that's my